James Records, our special guest, his book, The New Case for Gold. We're going to take your calls with him as we continue chatting on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, James Records with us, of course, The New Case for Gold. James, you were talking about some kind of new access of gold. What's going on?
Sure, George. I mean, the listeners understand the importance of gold and silver for an individual portfolio, but this plays a strategic role on a worldwide basis. And let me now go back to 2009. I was asked by the Pentagon to conduct the first ever financial war game. Of course, the Pentagon had been doing war games for decades. I talked about this in my first book, Currency Wars. But they had never done a financial war game before, where the only weapons allowed were stocks, bonds, derivatives, commodities, foreign exchange. And I was brought in for the capital markets expertise. We did this at a top-secret weapons laboratory about halfway between Washington and Baltimore. We had about 100 participants, the Fed, the Treasury, CIA, Homeland Security. We also had experts, professors, and I recruited some of my friends to Wall Street come down. I told the Pentagon, I said, wars are all about deception and deceit, so we ought to get some real Wall Streeters in here to make it realistic. So we did this over a couple of days, but the plot that we played out, Russia and China would combine their gold, put it in a vault in Switzerland, start a new bank in London. This London bank would issue a new currency, a new form of money backed by the gold. But the kicker was that Russia and China said, from now on, if you want Russian natural resource exports or Chinese manufactured goods, you can only pay for it in this new currency. We no longer accept dollars. It was a way to basically run the dollar off the road.
Wow.
Now, we knew this wouldn't happen the next day or the next year, but when you do a war game, you're trying to get the Pentagon to think 5 or 10 years over the horizon. That was the way the Chinese think. We were trying to help the Pentagon think the same way, and I give them a lot of credit for doing this. Now, we got laughed at by some of the people in the room. There was a Harvard professor. He literally laughed in my face. He said, "What's wrong with you? You're wasting our time. Don't you know that gold is not part of the international monetary system? It never will be again. This whole scenario is ridiculous." I said, "Look, let's just play it out, see how that turns out." And it turned out in some very interesting ways. But here's the point. This was 7 years ago. In those 7 years, China has tripled its gold reserves. Russia has more than doubled its gold reserves. In other words, China has bought somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 tons of gold. Russia has bought over 1,000 tons of gold. Just to put that in perspective, George, there are only 35,000 tons of official gold in the whole world. When I say official gold, I mean gold that's owned by central banks or owned by finance ministries.
Stockpiled somewhere.
There's only 35,000 tons. So the Russians and the Chinese together have bought over 5,000 tons, or 15% of all the official gold in the world, just in the last 7 years. So they're behaving exactly the way we warned the Pentagon they would behave in this effort to destroy the dollar. Now they're joined by another rogue nation, Iran. So I call Russia, China, and Iran the axis of gold. They're piling up gold. I just returned from Switzerland. I was in Switzerland about 10 days ago. Had dinner in Lugano, Switzerland, with the head of the world's largest gold refinery. He told me, so what does a gold refinery do? They take gold in the front door. They process it into a purer form, 99.99% pure. They call it four nines. And they sell it to customers. His customers, well, his biggest customer are the Chinese. The Chinese buy 10 tons a week. He said, they want 20. I won't sell it to them because I can't produce enough gold, and I have other customers I have to take care of. But he sells 10 tons a week to the Chinese. But here's his point. He's seeing physical shortages. He said, I've got all the customers I can handle who are buying from me. I can't get the gold. I mean, a refinery gets gold from three places. They get it from gold miners. They get it from what's called scrap, and that's just, you know, necklaces and jewelry and stuff like that. And they get existing 400-ounce bars from the vaults in London, but they're kind of like 99% pure, and the Chinese want 99.99%.
Wow, that's pretty pure. That's like Breaking Bad in their methamphetamine, right?
Correct. So he'll take two nines and turn it into what they call four nines, and the Chinese like these 1-kilo bars instead of these old 35-pound bars. But he said, I can't find the gold. He's working triple shifts, 24 hours a day. He's upgraded his factory. The Chinese will take all his. So that's what's going on. He's saying, you know, gold bars, if you've ever seen one of the old 400-ounce bars, they're like dollar bills. I mean, they got stamps on them. They've got a serial number, the stamp of the refiner. They have dates on them. Now, here's the point. When you load up a gold vault, it's what's called last in, first out. So the old gold is in the back of the vault. When new gold comes in, you stick it in the front of the vault, which means that when the vaults are being emptied out, the new bars go first, and then the old bars come out last because they're way in the back.
They're way in the back. They're too heavy.
They're too heavy. Well, they're all heavy, but they, yeah, but they don't want to move them any further than they have to. So my friend who runs this refinery in Switzerland, he says, I'm starting to see bars stamped 1980 with dates in the 1980s. That means the vaults are running low. In other words, these are bars that have been in there for...
They're getting to the back.
They're scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening to the London vaults. The Chinese are taking the gold and putting it away. You're not going to see that gold for hundreds of years. So we're looking at physical shortages. And the other thing, and here's where the geopolitics come in. Vladimir Putin has a 6,000-member cyber brigade working day and night to hack, delete, erase, and destroy digital financial records. I run into billionaires. Now, I live not far from Greenwich, Connecticut, New York City, so some of my friends are billionaires. And they'll say, what do you got? They go, well, I got stocks and bonds and all this. I say, no, you don't. You have electrons. Your wealth is digital, and it can be erased in a heartbeat.
In any time.
You have nothing left. And so the thing about gold, physical gold, it is physical. You can't hack it. You can't delete it. You can't erase it. You can melt it down. You can't trace it. And when the U.S. is in financial war with all these countries, by the way, going on behind the scenes. So what we do to the Russians, we kick them out of the payment system. We say, you can't have dollars. And if your companies want to refinance their bonds, they're not allowed to go into capital markets. The Russians say, who cares? We got gold. The Iranians have been smuggling gold in from Turkey and Iran. So they're getting outside our system. They're getting outside our digital payment system.
Are they outsmarting us by doing this?
They're totally outsmarting us. And, you know, you're absolutely right, George. It's a great question. And by the way, I spoke to the number two guy at the IMF, the number two person in the International Monetary Fund. This is the hidden central bank of the world. And I asked him about this because the IMF sold 400 times and China's buying thousands of times. And I said to Dr. Zhu, I said, well, who's right? You're selling, they're buying. I said, one of you has got to be on the wrong side of the trade. And he kind of shrugged and said, you know, China needs to rebalance the reserves away from what he called credit, which is basically U.S. paper, to hard assets. He was very relaxed about it. I spoke to one of the highest officials, actually the highest official in the U.S. intelligence community with economic responsibilities, and I said the same thing. I said, aren't you concerned that the Chinese are buying up all this gold? And he shrugged and said, his words were, somebody's got to own it, like it was a yard sale. So I've spoken to people at the highest levels in Western financial institutions and Western intelligence communities, and they look at it like, yeah, no big deal. The Chinese, yeah, maybe they need a little bit more gold. But when you look at the coming collapse of the international monetary system, you can see this is like a poker game. So imagine five guys sit down to play poker. It's China, Russia, U.S., Japan, and Europe. Europe would be represented by Germany. Mm-hmm. What do you want in a poker game? We all want a big pile of chips.
That's right.
Well, your gold is going to be your chips. Now, the first thing they're saying is, well, if one guy has all the chips, it's not a very good poker game because nobody else can ante up. So that's step one. You got to let the Chinese get some chips so they can play the game.
And India and all these other countries.
And a few other countries, that's right. But once the game starts, then everybody, you know, wants a pile of chips so you can have a pretty good game. Interestingly, Canada, believe it or not, just sold the last of their gold. Canada is the first major developed country.
No gold?
They have no gold. No gold. They didn't have a lot to begin with. They only had about three tons, but they sold it.
So they're on the fiat system, too.
Well, 100%. I mean, the U.S. is on the fiat system, but we at least have 8,000 tons. Europe has 10,000 tons.
And somebody's saying, what do they mean, the fiat system? Cars? No, no, no. Fiat system means there is nothing backing the money.
Correct. Fiat is a Latin word. It means because I say so. It means order or command. So dollars are money because the Fed says so, right? That's a fiat. It's just an order or the word yes in Latin. But gold is real money. Gold, and so the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians are piling it up. They're getting outside the digital system. And any U.S. citizen who doesn't have... Now, I recommend 10%. Don't sell everything and go all in on gold. You shouldn't go all in on
anything. On anything.
Right, that's exactly right. But, you know, I mentioned I was in Switzerland recently, and I was actually attending an investment conference. I was speaking at an investment conference in the remote corner of the Alps, a resort, you know, very far from any city. It was 3 hours from the nearest city. And I shared a car, flew into Zurich, and shared a car from the airport out to this resort. And the guy in the car with me, nice guy, he ran the pension fund of the country of Colombia. So basically, think of it like our social security system, except they actually fund it. We have nothing in our social security system except IOUs. But in Colombia and a lot of other countries, they actually put real money and they buy stuff. So he runs about $50 billion for the benefit of the people of Colombia. So I said to him, so how much gold do you have? He said, none. Zero.
Nothing.
So Putin can wipe him out. They can literally make that, they can erase that digital wealth. So if you have physical gold, Vladimir Putin can't hack it. You can't put negative interest rates on it. It's going to be the only way to preserve wealth in the meltdown, which, again, going back to what we talked about earlier with predictive analytics, you can see it coming. I can see this meltdown coming. I saw 2008 coming based on my experience in 1998. And having lived through two of these meltdowns, 98 and 2008, looks like a 10-year tempo. Just go out to 2018. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of people, jurors, they say, well, you know, Jim, I hear you. And so call me up at 3 o'clock the day before, and I'll sell my stocks and get some gold. And I have two answers to that. One is, I'm not going to know the day before. I know it's coming, and I know how big it's going to be.
It kind of creeps up on you, doesn't it?
Two things. It creeps up on you, but then when it happens really fast. And then people say, well, then I'm going to go get gold. You know, you're not going to be able to get it. When the price starts spiking, when I say spiking, you know, $100 an ounce, $200 an ounce, tomorrow $300 an ounce, and then it's at $2,000, $3,000, you're going to watch it go up on TV, but you're not going to be able to get it. You're going to call your dealer. They're going to be sold out. You're going to call the mint. They're going to be backordered. You're not going to be able to get it. So the time to get it is now. So when all this happens, you just sit tight, and, you know, nobody wishes for it to happen, but it will happen, and you're watching on TV, but at least you'll have your gold.
What about gold and silver futures? Too risky?
Very bad idea, and here's why. Because these are paper contracts. There are a couple of different kinds of paper gold. I talked about this in my book, The New Case for Gold. I explained the difference between paper gold and physical gold. Gold futures, gold ETFs, that's an exchange-traded fund, gold contracts from the big banks, they all have termination clauses in them. So here's what's going to happen. So let's just take gold futures, because that's a good choice. There is a vault with some gold in it that backs up the futures contracts. But there are $100 of futures for every $1 of gold. And they expect that the people with the futures contracts, they might cash them out, take your profits or your losses, roll them over into another month. But they don't think people are going to demand the gold. But you have a right to ask for the gold. If 100 people show up for gold and there's only one bar of gold, the first guy might get the bar of gold, but the other 99 are not going to get it. They're going to get a notice, you know, by email or whatever,
mm-hmm.
saying your contract is closed out as of yesterday's price. They won't steal your money. They'll give you yesterday's price, but you're sitting there saying, wait a second, I want today's price and tomorrow's price. And the reason I bought it, gold is going to the moon, and I bought this contract because I want that profit. And they're going to say, sorry, we closed you out yesterday because we don't have the gold. And the same thing with the London banks. We talked about leasing earlier. So they lease, let's say, a ton of gold from Fort Knox. So the U.S. government leases a ton of gold to J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan can sell 100 tons on paper. And by the way, they do. This is how they suppress the price. But now you got 100 people. They all show up for the ton of gold. J.P. Morgan has one ton. They might look around for one or two more. But most of those people, those contracts are going to be terminated. So if you have paper gold, when you want it the most, when the price is skyrocketing and you most want your gold, you're going to find out you don't have it. Your contract has been terminated. If you have physical gold, not a problem. You just sit tight.
Well, this whole thing is intriguing to me, James, because I can see it unfold. One more question, then we'll go to phone calls for people lining up here for you. Was Saddam Hussein trying to get us off oil for gold? Oil for dollars? He was trying to get us off that standard?
Well, that program had more holes in it than a Swiss cheese. And Saddam was basically had run rings around it because there was corruption at the United Nations. Kofi Annan was the head of the UN at the time. His son was neck deep in it. I mean, that was one of the most corrupt programs ever. Saddam was getting all the money he wanted. But he had the same problem that the Russians and the Chinese have today, which is the U.S. does control the dollar payment system. You move a dollar anywhere in the world, I don't care where it is, it goes through a system, a wire system that the U.S. controls. If you're okay with that, fine. But if you're an enemy of the United States, so you're on the target list, or you're an adversary, that money is subject to being interdicted, seized by the United States, and we are very good at that. So the rogue nations, or the enemy nations, they want gold because it doesn't go over a wire system. You can put it on a plane and put it on a backpack if you want.
Yeah.
You can smuggle it, but you can melt it down, change the identity, very hard to trace. So that's why they want gold. Interestingly, Iraq today, same problem. Actually, the Islamic State is using gold. I mean, the bad guys use gold to for the same reason. Good guys should have gold to avoid negative interest rates and other kinds of adverse economic consequences. So, I mean, gold, we're on a shadow gold standard. We always have been. Nobody talks about it. Nobody admits it. But to this day, the U.S. government is on a shadow gold standard.
What about bitcoins?
Well, Bitcoin is a form of money. I'm not a technophobe. I understand the technology. I've actually worked with United States Special Operations Command down at MacDill in Tampa, because the Islamic State is using cryptocurrencies. Also, we were working on a project to interdict the use of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies by the Islamic State. So it's money. But the problem, I have two problems with Bitcoin. It hasn't been through an economic cycle. Bitcoin was invented in 2009. The global and the U.S. economy have been growing since 2009. Growth has been weak. It has not been a great recovery, but it's been growing. But we don't know how Bitcoin behaves in a downturn. I've seen stocks, bonds, gold, currencies. I've seen everything else through up cycles and down cycles. We've never seen Bitcoin through a down cycle, so we actually don't know how it behaves, number one. Number two, Bitcoin has the same vulnerabilities we've been talking about, which are digital hacking or even just the power grid. It doesn't have to be a hack. What if the power grid goes down? You know, and Ted Koppel just wrote a book.
Yeah, on cyber attacks.
Lights Out is the name of his book.
Yep.
And, you know, like, you can't put gas in your car because the gas pumps are electric. You can't go to the ATM because
that's right. You can't go to the store.
So try getting your Bitcoin in that situation. So it's another reason I've gone. And silver has a place. You know, in the event of a real social breakdown, a power grid goes down and nothing works, you're going to want to go out and buy groceries. If you have a gold coin, that's probably a year's worth of groceries. You might just want to buy a couple days' worth of groceries. So I think a silver coin, a 1 ounce American Silver Eagle, is useful in that. So I mainly recommend gold for wealth preservation, but I think everybody should have what's called a monster box. That monster box is 500 1 ounce silver coins. They cost about $10,000. You can get them from the U.S. Mint or any reputable dealer, and that'll be your in Philadelphia we call it walking around money, but there's 500 1 ounce silver coins. That'll be your walking around money if the power grid's down.
And then I'm afraid if the power grid goes down, people are just going to take, Jim.
Well, unfortunately, yeah. I mean, we saw this in Katrina. You know, it was a tough 10 days down there. But within 48 hours, two things emerged. Mobs emerged of looters, people who were just breaking into stores. But vigilantes emerged side by side. The vigilantes, like, we don't want to loot anybody, but we do want to stop the mobs. So you had mobs of looters and mobs of vigilantes on the streets in New Orleans within 48 hours of that storm. So it's sad, but that's just human nature.
Yeah, indeed it is. Okay, let's go to the calls. Let's start with Nick in Michigan to get us going. Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, good evening.
Hi there.
I have several points to make, George. The first of which, the executive order of either March or April 5/33, purportedly banning the private ownership of gold. Well, guess what? I guess your guest is grossly, reprehensibly ignorant of the fact that executive orders apply only to government functionaries and those who are contracted into the United States Corporation. So that would mean District of Columbia residents, the federal territories, and your favorite flavor of federal politics.
Well, hold on for a sec. We're going to take this break. We'll talk more, and of course, we'll have Jim Rickards react to that in just a second. Well, a couple events I want you to be aware of. Everything's at coasttocoastam.com. This weekend, Victory of Light in Cincinnati, Ohio. Looking forward to that. Those of you in that area, come on out and see us with a lot of the events for me on Saturday. And then on June 18th in the St. Louis area, a major live event at Lindenwood University. We've got Stanton Friedman coming, rock historian R. Gary Patterson, our affiliate here, 97.1. Mark Farley and Mark Close will be there talking about the unusual and the strange. And we've got some music, and we're just going to have some fun. Tickets available at 971-TALK. That's the website, 971talk.com. Look for the section there where it says George Norrie coming home. Click that, and then you can click away and order the tickets. 971talk.com. The theater, I'm told, holds 1,000 people plus, so let's load it up as we do all over the country. And welcome back to Coast, James Rickards with us. Of course, Nick from Michigan, of course, was talking about the executive order. And I got to tell you, Jim, I think you're right. Executive Order 6102, which was signed in 1933 by Roosevelt, forbids the hoarding of gold, gold bullion, gold certificates within the United States. People can be arrested and fined for it. It wasn't just in certain regions.
That's right. You know, I respect disagreement, but, you know, Nixon, I was grossly ignorant of the impact of executive orders. Just for the listeners' benefit, George, because they may know me as an economist and as an author, but I also happen to be a lawyer. I have two law degrees from the two of the top 10 law schools in the country. So I think I know a little bit about executive orders. Now, in a narrow sense, it may be the president ordering a branch of the government to do something, but the something affects people. If the president orders the Treasury to seize assets from Iran, Iran's not sitting there saying, hey, I don't work for the federal government. They seize their assets. So, yeah, I mean, that was done through the post office and Treasury stations. But you're exactly right, George. It affected every citizen in America. And it was a $10,000 fine. But in 1933 dollars,
that's a lot of money.
Today's dollars, it would be, I did the math, it's over $100,000, which is a huge fine. There are lots of really bad things you only get fined $50,000 for. So it was a big deal. Interesting footnote. President Roosevelt, he said, what was his statutory authority for the executive order? The answer is he used the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917, which was a Woodrow Wilson World War I statute that the United States used to seize German assets in America. That's how we got Bayer Aspirin. There's a big German pharmaceutical company, Bayer AG. We took their U.S. affiliates. We got Bayer Aspirin. But my question, in 1933, why was Roosevelt using the Trading with the Enemy Act? Who was the enemy?
Yeah.
It must have been the American people.
And when you brought the gold in, did you get paid for it?
You got paid about $20 an ounce. They didn't steal it. This is the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. They got to give you compensation. But here's the trick. Roosevelt knew that he was going to raise the price. He didn't know how high. It ended up being $35. He knew he was going to raise the price. So what he did, he confiscated the gold at $20. He raised the price to $35. And that $15 an ounce profit, 75% profit, by the way, that went to the government, not the people, because it was like insider trading, right? He buys it at 20 and raises it to 35. Now, that difference, that $15 an ounce profit, that was the start of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which to this day, in 2016, is an unaccountable Treasury slush fund that does not require congressional approval to spend. Bob Rubin in 1994 used that fund to bail out Mexico. Congress refused to pass a bailout. Rubin said, I don't care what the Congress says. I'm going to take my slush fund, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and to bail out Mexico, and he did. So to this day, there's an unaccountable, unappropriated slush fund inside the Treasury, and that money came from taking gold at 20 and marking it up to $35 an ounce.
Let's go to Sherry in Scottsdale, Arizona, first-time caller. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
Hey, good evening to you, too, or good morning, wherever you are.
Yes, almost morning. I'm in Arizona, so we're still evening. my question, two-part question, actually. The Federal Reserve, is it a private banking cartel? And you mentioned that there were a group of 10 gentlemen that sit on the BIS. Could you name those guys?
Thank you, Sherry. First of all, the Federal Reserve is privately owned. It's a really convoluted system. There are 12 regional reserve banks. There's one in Boston, one in Philadelphia, one in Dallas, St. Louis. So they're all over the country. There are 12 of them. It kind of reminds me of the Hunger Games. You know, you got these 12 zones. But those banks are privately owned by the banks in the region. So the big New York banks own the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The big Texas banks own the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and so on.
Privately, not part of the U.S. government.
Correct. And I actually I had dinner down in Austin with the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and I was teasing him a little bit about the government. He looked at me and said, well, you know, Jim, I've never had a government job. And I said, Mr. President, you're right.
That's right.
You work for the Fed. So that's true. And the second part of the question
about these people.
You know, I talk about the global monetary elite, the power elite, but it's not a deep, dark conspiracy. We know who these people are. It's Janet Yellen at the Federal Reserve and her vice chairman, Stanley Fischer. It's Mario Draghi at the ECB. It's Kuroda at the Bank of Japan. You know, Carstens and the Bank of Mexico. So we know who they are. And they get advice from, university professors, Marty Feldstein and Larry Summers at Harvard, Rick Mishkin at Columbia. I mean, it's, we know, and, you know, Madame Lagarde, Christine Lagarde at the International Monetary Fund, they actually put out a lot of stuff on their websites, but I call them transparently non-transparent. And what I mean by that is they do put a lot of information out, but first of all, no one bothers to read it. And even if you do, you have to be a technically trained expert to understand it. And most of the people with that expertise work for them. So the number of people who actually understand it but aren't in the system, it's like five people. It's like me. I mean, there are a couple other people who do this, but there are very few people who understand what they're doing but are not sort of under their thumb.
And here's an interesting take, too. Why does the president appoint the chairman of the Fed when it's a private organization? Do they basically tell him, this is who we want?
Sure, because look at, let's go back a couple years, the 2014 Bernanke's term was over. The White House wanted Larry Summers. I mean, that's not a secret. The White House wanted Larry Summers, and they didn't get it. They got Janet Yellen because that's who the academic establishment wanted. That's who the power elite wanted because she's in the club. So there's a perfect example. I mean, the White House wanted Larry Summers. They didn't get it. They got told they had to appoint Janet Yellen, and then the president did.
Next up, we go to Gordon in Lakeland, Florida. Gordon, thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
James. First, I want to acknowledge that you're right. Historically, gold and silver have been used even back to the Bible days. But now we see a lot of people are forecasting that there's going to be a collapse and even a famine or something where it'll take a day's worth of wages to pay for a day's worth of food in Revelation 6:6, for example, and even non-religious people agree this. So there's two questions. One, what could be the causes of this? I'm thinking either war, famine, maybe governmental oppression, but more importantly, how can actually gold help out? Because we have a lot of arable land, and we can produce food for people, even though there's going to be some rich, powerful elites. And when you, and more specifically, when you have these silver things that people walk around with, you discussed, how are you going to know the real from the fake? And how can it actually be used as currency? I'm thinking that bartering would be more effective. And I know that there's a lot of power elites where you have college students that are so deeply in debt. And that was something they didn't bargain for. And there's a lot more examples of that. But, I mean, I don't think that we're going to go broke, and I just don't see the Native American, the Cree Native American said, when the last piece of land has been used up, the last drop of water has been drunk, the last fish eaten, the last tree cut down, the white man will discover he cannot eat money. And so the money will, the gold and the silver will help, but how can it be useful when you can't tell a real silver from a fake one or something? How will it be any more useful than bartering, if you could?
Okay, well, Gordon, first I'll say a great, great question. It's a 10-part question, so let me take it one part at a time. So the first thing, remember, I said 10% gold, 10% gold or silver. Well, that leaves 90%. I think land should be part of the portfolio, so I don't disagree with you about the importance of land and agricultural land and residential land. So I agree with that. So I say, you know, 10% gold and silver, but that leaves 90%. There's plenty of room for land in the portfolio, so I don't really disagree with that. As far as real from the fake, this is why I recommend American Gold Eagles and American Silver Eagles. They come from the U.S. Mint. They, by the way, I'm not a dealer. I don't get paid if somebody buys gold. I'm an author and an analyst. But American Gold Eagles, American Silver Eagles, the 1 ounce coins, they say, you know, they've come from the mint. They say, in God we trust. They're beautiful designs. That's a pretty good badge of authenticity. Now, you can't completely rule out. Pick up a silver coin with a magnet. If it's got lead in it, it'll be magnetized. So that's one way to tell. The second thing, as far as you're right, you can't eat money, but you can spend it. And so let's say you're in a rural area and you don't have a lot of produce, but you got a stack of silver, and the guy a mile down the road, he's got some produce. You can walk down there. He'll take some silver coins in exchange for his produce. It's no different than going to the store. Look, you know, go back to, it's not the Stone Age. We're not talking about the Ice Age. We're talking about maybe early 19th century. John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, they used silver coins to buy, you know, agricultural produce from their neighbors. By the way, there is no history of barter in the history of the world. Money and credit, actually credit is older than money. Like, I'll give you the goods in exchange for a promise to come back later and pay me something. So credit and money are much, there's no evidence of barter. Barter is a myth that kind of the economists came up with. So you're right that you can't eat money, but you can spend money to get food. And I don't recommend putting 100% of your wealth in gold. I recommend 10%. And there is room for, as I say, for some land, or rather assets, fine art. And then finally, as far as being able to see it coming, you can absolutely see it coming. And the cause doesn't matter, because people ask me all the time, they say, well, Jim, what's it going to be? Is it going to be a war, a natural disaster, an assassination, a scandal, et cetera? And I say, it doesn't matter. What matters is the instability of the system as a whole. It's the snowflake and the avalanche. Don't worry about the snowflake, because it's coming. Worry about the avalanche. Worry about the whole system, the instability. That's what you can see, what's called the density function, the complexity, the scale. That's how we know this collapse is going to be bigger than anything in history.
Well said. Sherry in Memphis, Tennessee, your turn. You're on with Jim Rickard. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
And Jim, this is really a wonderful program. I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
You've answered a lot of my questions already, and I called it to ask, Jim, if he knows about the book Shemitah by Jonathan Kahn, who talks about the cyclical every 7 years.
The Shemitah.
Yeah, the Shemitah. But also, I have a question. My question is, you've answered a lot, but my question is, if we come to this collapse, and Russia and China have more gold than we have, and if we come to this world collapse, what kind of a situation is the United States going to be in? How are we going to bear? And if I know the power of the United States results by the economy and the military, but if we don't have very much gold and our economy is going down compared to Russia and China, what kind of a situation are we going to be in?
Well, that's a great question, Sherry. Just on Jonathan Kahn, it's funny you ask, because about 10 days ago, maybe a little bit less, I spent a couple days with Rabbi Jonathan Kahn and met him personally. Got a nice photo. He was preaching. I was in the audience, and then I was giving a speech the next day. So we were both at a prophetic conference. We were both speakers. So a really nice guy, very down to earth. I autographed my book. He autographed his book. So I very much enjoyed meeting him. Very powerful preacher. Now, what he talks about, I'm not as expert in the seven-year Shemitah, but I do look at the book of Leviticus, which talks about a 50-year Jubilee. And what the Jubilee does, you probably know this, was all the debts were forgiven. And people say, gee, isn't that a really bad deal for the lenders? You know, like you're a lender and you expect someone to pay you back, but all the debts are forgiven every 50 years. Doesn't that kind of stink for you? And the answer is that everybody saw it coming. Everyone knew. So if you're 10 years into the new Jubilee, you might make a 10-year loan, and you're okay. But if you're 40 years into the Jubilee, and you know it's coming in 10 years, you're not going to make a 10-year loan in year 41, right? You're not going to do that because you know you're not going to get paid. So what does that force you to do? It forces you to reduce the scale of the system. As you get closer to the Jubilee year, there's less lending, less leverage, less credit. The system is voluntarily scaling down, which means it doesn't collapse. It was actually the ancient Israelites understood modern physics and complexity theory better than Janet Yellen, because we keep letting our system grow. We never have a Jubilee, and then it does collapse. If you had something like the Jubilee out of the book of Leviticus, you would be it's exactly like the ski patrol setting dynamite to blow up, to force avalanches so they don't happen by accident. So there's a lot to be said for that. You know, Rabbi Kahn thinks about it in prophetic biblical terms, which I think is very interesting. I think of it as a physicist, and I say the Israelites had a very good idea because they forced their system to break up voluntarily before it collapsed. On your second point, what's coming when the collapse happens? Well, there actually is a kind of the International Monetary Fund, which is a shadow central bank of the world, has their own money. It's called the Special Drawing Right, or the SDR for short. Now, people make it complicated, but it's really very simple. The Federal Reserve can print dollars. The European Central Bank can print euros. The IMF can print SDRs. They can print their own money and hand it out, and they do. There's nothing new about it. They've been around since 1969. There have been hundreds of billions of SDRs that have been issued. When the collapse comes, go back to 98. 98, Wall Street bailed out a hedge fund. In 2008, the central banks bailed out Wall Street. In 2018, you're going to have to bail out the central banks. In other words, each bailout gets bigger than the one before. So who's bigger than the central banks? Who can create money when the central banks themselves fail? The answer is the IMF. So they're going to try to flood the world with these SDRs. And the way I think about it, it's going to be a horse race between gold and SDRs. They're going to try the SDRs, but I think people are going to say, hey, we've lost confidence in dollars, euros, and yen. Why should we have any more confidence in this other kind of fiat money you're telling us about, these SDRs? We want gold. So the power elites are going to try to force SDRs down your throat as a global liquidity tool. I think everyday citizens are going to go to gold. It'll be a very powerful struggle between the two.
Jim, when this thing hits again, is it going to be as bad as 2007 and 8?
It's going to be much worse, George. And when I say that, I want to be clear. I don't like to make claims that I can't back up. So why do I say it's going to be much worse? It has to do with the complexity theory we've been talking about. And I talk about this in my book, The New Case for Gold. In other words, when you double a system, how much did the risk go up? Well, if you ask Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan, he would say, well, the risk didn't go up at all because, you know, I doubled it, but it's long, short, long, short, long, short, so everything offsets. If you ask everyday citizens, they would use intuition. They say, well, if you double the risk, you double the system, you probably double the risk. That's incorrect. The technical answer is if you double the system, you increase the risk by a factor of 10 or maybe 100. That's an exponential increase in the risk. That's how complex systems work. So in 2008, what did we hear? Too big to fail, too big to fail, too big to fail. Guess what?
That's
Since 2008, the biggest banks are bigger. They own a larger percentage of the banking assets. Their derivatives books are much bigger. Everything that was too big to fail in 2008 is bigger today. And when you apply the exponential function, it's easy to see the next collapse is going to be much, much greater.
There will be no more bailouts, will they?
No. What they're going to do next time, they're not going to be able to bail it out. They're going to lock it down. So they're just going to reprogram the ATMs. You can get maybe $300 a day for gas and groceries. They're going to shut down the exchange.
For how long, Jim?
Well, they'll say temporary, but it might become permanent. You know, when Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, ended the gold standard, go back and look at that speech. He said, I am temporarily.
Yeah, exactly, and look what happened to it. Jim, we're out of time. Thank you so much. The name of his new book, The New Case for Gold, and his website, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com.